Chapter 40 Bear came through as promised. Therry had called the bush pilot on the radio, told him she needed to evacuate nearly 50 people, and pleaded for his help. Asking no questions, Bear had rallied every bush pilot within a 100-mile radius. Float planes streamed in from every direction to airlift the passengers from the shore of the lake. The sick and elderly went on first, then the young. Therry stood on the beach, feeling a mixture of relief and sadness, and waved goodbye to her new friend Rachel. Ryan's bloody badge of courage qualified him for a ride on one of the first planes out. With his shoulder wound patched up to stem the bleeding and prevent infection, he and the others were taken to a small but well-equipped provincial hospital. The Aguirre's brothers arranged their own transportation, calling in the Eurocopter to fly them back to the yacht with the news of their loss. Before they left, Ben and some of the younger men in the tribe went back across the lake to see what was left of Barker's complex. On their return, they reported that nothing remained. When Therry asked about the fate of the monster fish she had seen, Ben simply smiled and said, "Barbecued." Therry, Ben, and Mercer were among the last to leave. This time, the fuzzy dice in Bear's cockpit were reassuring. As the float plane wheeled over the vast forest, she looked down at the huge blackened area around the devastated side of Barker's incredible building. "Looks like we had a little forest fire down there," Bear yelled over the drone of the engine. "You folks know anything about that?" "Someone must have been careless with a match," Mercer said. Seeing the skeptical expression in Bear's eyes, Mercer grinned and said, "When we get back, I'll tell you the whole story over a beer." It actually took quite a few beers. Austin and Zavala, in the meantime, enjoyed their reunion with the Trouts and the leisurely cruise back to port on Throckmorton's research vessel. Throckmorton was still in a state of shock at the revelation of Barker's mad scheme and promised to testify before Senator Graham's congressional committee once he had filled in Parliament about the dangers of genetically modified fish. Back in Washington, Austin met with Sandecker to fill him in on the mission. The Admiral listened to the story of Barker's demise with rapt attention, but he saved most of his fascination for Durandal. He held the sword gingerly in his hands. Unlike many men of the sea, Sandecker was not superstitious, so Austin hiked an eyebrow when the Admiral gazed at the shimmering blade and murmured, "This weapon is haunted, Kurt. It seems to have a life of its own." "I had the same feeling," Austin said. "When I first picked it up, an electric current seemed to flow from the hilt into my arm." Sandecker blinked as if he were coming out of a spell and slid the sword back into its scabbard. "Superstitious rubbish, of course." "Of course. What do you suggest we do with it?" "There's no question in my mind. We return it to its last rightful owner. Roland is dead, and if the mummy I saw is Diego's, he won't be putting any claims on Durandal anytime soon. Let me think about it. Do you mind if I borrow the sword in the meantime?" "Not at all, although I could use it to cut through the mounds of paperwork." Sandecker lit his cigar and tossed the match into his fireplace. Flashing his familiar crocodile grin, he said, "I've always found fire to be much more effective in dealing with the effluent of our federal bureaucracy." Sandecker's summons came a couple of days later. The Admiral's voice crackled over the phone. "Kurt, if you have a minute, could you please come up to my office? Round up Joe, too. There are some people here who want to see you." Austin tracked down Zavala in the deep submergence design lab and gave him Sandecker's message. They arrived outside the Admiral's office at the same time. The receptionist smiled and waved them through. Sandecker greeted them at the door and ushered them into the nerve center of Numa. "Kurt, Joe, Good of you to come, he said effusively, taking them by the arm. Austin smiled at Sandecker's disingenuous welcome. One had little choice when Sandecker called. Those who arrived late or not at all suffered the full weight of the Admiral's wrath. Standing behind Sandecker was Balthazar Aguirrez and his two sons. Balthazar roared with pleasure when he saw Austin. He pumped Austin's hand and Zavala's in his lobster grip. I asked Mr. Aguirrez and his sons to stop by so we could thank them for helping us in Canada, Sandecker said. I've been telling them about your mission. We couldn't have done it without your help, Austin said. Sorry for the loss of your pilot and helicopter, and for Pablo's injury. Aguirrez waved his hand in dismissal. Thank you, my friend. The helicopter was only a machine and can easily be replaced. As you can see, my son's wound is healing nicely. The death of the pilot was a shame, but like all the men on my boat, he was a highly paid mercenary and well aware of the dangers of his chosen profession. Nonetheless, a tragic loss. Agreed. I'm pleased with the success of your mission, but do you have any news of the sword and the horn? It seems your relics had a long and arduous journey, Sandecker said. With the help of the log Kurt discovered in Barker's macabre museum, we've been able to piece the story together. Your ancestor, Diego, sailed across the Atlantic from the Faroe Islands, but he never reached land. He and his crew died, most likely from disease. The ship drifted into the polar ice. Zeppelin discovered the caravel hundreds of years later after a secret flight to the North Pole and removed the body of your ancestor. Mechanical problems forced the airship down on the ice. The Keolia found it and removed the bodies of Diego and the Zeppelin's captain, Heinrich Braun. Kurt has told me this story, Aguirrez said impatiently. But what of the relics? Sandecker said, Gentlemen, I'm being rude. Please, sit down. I think it's time for some brandy. The Admiral waved his guests to the comfortable leather chairs in front of his massive desk and went over to a bar hidden behind a wall panel. He brought back a bottle of B&B and poured each man a snifter of brandy. He stuck his nose in the wide-mouthed glass, closed his eyes, and took a deep breath. Then he unlocked his humidor and produced a handful of his specially rolled cigars. He passed the cigars around and patted the breast pocket of his navy blazer. I seem to have lost my cigar clipper. You gentlemen don't happen to have a knife. Never mind. He reached into the chair well of his desk, pulled out a scabbard, and laid it on the desk. Perhaps this will do. Balthazar's dark eyes widened in disbelief. He rose from his chair and reached out for the scabbard, cradling it with both hands as if it were made of glass. With shaking fingers, he slid the sword from the scabbard and held it high above his head as if he were rallying Charlemagne's legions to battle. His lips formed a single whispered word. Durandal. The horn will arrive in a few days, along with the remains of your ancestor, Sandecker said. I thought you might be able to put these priceless relics together with their rightful owner. Balthazar slid the sword back into the scabbard and passed it on to his sons. The rightful owners are the Basque people. I will use the sword and horn of Roland to ensure that the Basques finally attain their sovereignty. He smiled. But in a peaceful manner. The glee at the success of his theatrical gesture was evident in Sandecker's clear blue eyes. He raised his glass high. Let's drink to that, he said. Ryan called Austin later that day and said he was back in Washington. He asked Austin to meet him at the usual place. Austin arrived at Roosevelt Island a few minutes early and was waiting in front of the statue when he saw Ryan coming his way. Austin noticed that Ryan was still pale and gaunt from his wound. There was something else. The arrogant tilt of the chin and the boyish know-it-all grin that had flawed Ryan's good looks and irritated Austin were gone. Ryan seemed more serious and mature. He smiled and extended his hand.
Thanks for coming, Kurt.
How do you feel?
Like I've been used for target practice.
I wish I could say you get used to it, Austin said, recalling the bullet and knife scars that marked his own body. Knowing that you drove a spike into Barker's plans must help ease the pain.
Congratulations.
Couldn't have done it without the help of Ben and Chuck and Diego Aguirre's.
Don't be modest.
You're the one who's being modest. I heard about your adventures aboard the Zeppelin. I hope this isn't turning into a mutual admiration society, Austin said. I wouldn't want to ruin a wonderful relationship.
Ryan laughed.
I asked you here so I could apologize. I know I've been more than a little overbearing and self-righteous.
Happens to the best of us.
There's something else. I tried to use Theri to leverage your help.
I know.
I also know that Theri is too independent-minded to be used.
I had to apologize anyhow, before I leave.
You sound as if you're heading off into the sunset. Like Shane? No. I'm not quite ready for that. I'm off to Bali in a few days to see if SOS can stop the illegal trade in sea turtles. Then I've got to help with a sea lion rescue in South Africa and see what we can do about poaching in the Galapagos Marine Reserve. In between, I'll be raising funds to replace the Sentinel.
An ambitious schedule. Good luck.
I'll need it.
Ryan checked his watch.
Sorry to run, but I've got to line up the troops.
They walked back to the parking lot where they shook hands once more.
I understand you're seeing Theri later this week.
We're having dinner as soon as we crawl out from our office work.
I promise not to interrupt you the way I did back in Copenhagen.
Don't worry, Austin said. He glanced at the sky, a mysterious smile on his lips.
Where I'm taking Theri for dinner this time, no one will interrupt us.